Muddy Knees Media.
Totally Football Show. Today, Jose has Bergwijn and a big tonic, but it's bitter for Pep as Spurs do City again. Elsewhere, Man United point out move to Iggulu. Makes sense given they're living at minus 38. And at Selhurst Park, another story of a man from the Palace crossing the line with his wandering hands. We round up all the news that matters and more in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Morning, listener. Thank you so much for joining us, or afternoon, if you just got round to it. But here we are anyway, bright and early, with a pretty bright Premier League weekend of action and some other stuff as well. But here to tell us all about it, we got the man who wrote the book on speaking about football, Tom Williams.
Good morning, James.
Good morning to you. Matt Davis Adams is also here.
Hello, James.
Hi, Matt. It's not actually morning for us, is it?
No, that's why I didn't say good morning. Yeah. It just feels a bit dishonest. But
it does, doesn't it? Artistic license, Matt. I think we'll put that down too. Also with us, Sasha Gurionov.
Hello, James.
Hi to you, Sasha. You're in ebullient form.
Oh, I just ran here from White Hart Lane.
Crikey. A certain result having put wings on your heels, I imagine. 22 points now, Sasha. 22 points between Liverpool at the top of the table and Man City in second place. It is the biggest lead that a team has ever had in English top division history. Duncan Alexander pointing out, if you combine Man United and Wolves points this season, Liverpool would still be a win ahead of them. Sasha, it's done, isn't it? Can you say it's done? You're going to win the title? Can you say that?
It was done at Christmas, as soon as City lost at Wolves. I felt that was the moment. That was the time when I built myself a spreadsheet trying to predict when Liverpool are likely to win the league. True.
When's it going to happen, Sasha?
Well, because Liverpool have been overperforming and City underperforming, right, it looks like it could well be at Goodison Park.
So the next fixtures, you got Norwich away, you'll win that surely. West Ham at home, Watford away, Bournemouth at home, then Goodison. But that's you need six wins, basically. That's the fifth game is Everton. So if Man City drop a game, in the meantime, you'll win it at Goodison if you win all those games.
So exactly. So in the intervening period, City have either got to draw two games or lose one.
Okay.
Which, seeing today's evidence, I mean, they just keep on wasting chances and shooting themselves in the foot, getting sent off where they shouldn't be sent off. And I think it's City's doing, to be honest.
Well, it's also Liverpool's doing, surely. March the 16th is when that derby game with Everton comes up. That would be, of course, unprecedentedly early for anyone to win the title. The previous best, certainly in the Premier League era, was in mid-April, Man United back in 2001. This would be extraordinary. Are you slightly worried, even slightly worried about Goodison maybe being a stumbling block?
To be honest, if Liverpool do win the title at Goodison Park, it will be the most perfect of perfect seasons. But if they fail to win it at Goodison Park, well, it's going to be a slightly less perfect season for Liverpool than it has been so far. I think, if anything, I know my Evertonian friends are getting a little bit nervous about the whole concept of this happening. But from Liverpool's point of view, I mean, I went to see West Ham Liverpool in midweek, and they're an extraordinary team to watch. I mean, of course, you know, you try to imagine what it'd be like for neutrals or even those West Ham fans, but everything that they do is so much more precise than anyone else in the league at the moment. They are able to pace themselves through the game when they up the tempo. A team like West Ham just has no idea what to do.
You know, it's funny because we were talking when we were watching Spurs-Man City about how many good teams there are, or how many teams are actually in good form right now in the Premier League, and we got as far as Liverpool, and then what happened, Matt?
And then we tried to find somebody else. I tried to make a case for Leicester, and we looked at the form table, and we couldn't really justify Leicester.
Wolves were mentioned.
Wolves were mentioned. I looked at the form table. They're near the very bottom of the form table.
Right.
Yeah, it's one genuinely excellent side. And I think it would be a shame if the narrative toward the end of the season kind of shifted toward the deficiencies of other teams rather than the brilliance of Liverpool, because they are a genuinely brilliant Premier League team and should be remembered and regarded as such, I think.
Absolutely.
What's amusing is the attempts by fans of Liverpool's rivals to suggest that the lack of suspense in the title race means that when Liverpool eventually do cross the line, it will be in some way underwhelming, which is tremendous clutching at straws from fans of Man United and Everton and all the rest of them. But when you've waited 30 years, they are not going to care. Obviously, to do it at Goodison would be great. To do it at the Etihad would be great. But it doesn't matter, does it, really?
I think also, I mean, say if you take the Southampton game, Southampton played really well. Mm. They really disrupted the flow. And Liverpool came out second half and they changed up the game. They threw in a diagonal, which no one probably else can play, from Trent Alexander-Arnold. That set up, I think, was the second goal. And they keep on finding solutions, which other teams are just not capable of doing to the same extent.
Liverpool, a billion points clear, thereabouts, at the top of the table. Down at the other end, irons in the fire, very much as West Ham drop into the bottom three. And Watford are in some trouble as well. We'll talk about all those things. The other big race going on. Just 4 points now between Chelsea in the Champions League places and Spurs in fifth after that crazy game at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. That's where we're heading next.
You're listening to the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power.
Spurs, Man City. Sasha, you were there. Steven Bergwijn, what a corker.
That whole goal, though. You know what I actually prefer? Pass leading to it.
Reverend Lucas Moura.
Lucas Moura played that ball. Nobody else on the pitch saw that. Nobody else in the crowd saw it. It was just gasp. And suddenly it's completely the wrong place from what everyone expects. Right. And the finish was stupendous, of course.
He kind of just squared it, didn't he?
No, he didn't. He chipped it while everyone was pretty much, I think, looking the other way.
All right, OK.
I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm thinking too much into this, but I really enjoyed the pass.
I thought it was a very clever pass, because you assume when the ball comes out to a player in that sort of position that his options are basically to just sort of put it back into the mixer, or they will almost always aim for the back poke. So it was a clever pass. And it was a curious finish, because the ball moves from his chest to his foot so quickly. He sort of deliberately chests it down. Ordinarily, when a player takes a ball on his chest, the ball goes airborne for a bit and then lands in a sort of gentle parabola onto their foot, whereas I guess Bergwijn, conscious that he didn't have the time or the space to do anything else, sort of chest it down onto his foot, and he's kind of swinging his foot back, kind of cocking the trigger as the ball leaves his chest. And one of those that, you know, sort of cliche klaxon, but it's in from the moment you hit it. And I really enjoyed the look of just complete delight on his face. I mean, a face partly obscured by his hand, because that's obviously his trademark celebration, I assume. But yeah, a really kind of joyous moment. Yeah, unless you're a City fan.
I liked the pass. I thought the goal was brilliant, but the celebration was the best part of it for me. It's one of the greatest things in football when somebody's so overcome with emotion and joy at scoring a goal. You know, in that circumstance, in a game being watched by everybody who's interested in football on your debut in, you know, such a great arena. Fabulous for him.
This is probably the moment that maybe got this new Tottenham Stadium going. For Mourinho, this is a huge win. I think for Spurs, like in the new ground, this is the big, big victory I think they've been waiting for all this time. And for a debutant to do it too, I think it's fantastic.
Right. Looks a real prospect there. That was his first shot on or off target. It was Spurs' first shot on or off target, as they do it again to Man City, who had all the possession, all the shots, but this time having drawn in a similar fashion at the Etihad in the reverse fixture, this time come away with absolutely zippo. What is it with City that this game, their previous game, which was also goalless, so many other performances recently, they have had so much possession, they have had so many chances, and they haven't had the goals?
It's a strange period of the season for them in the Premier League, definitely, as was alluded to post-match by Guardiola, in that, you know, they are clearly the second best team. They have no concerns in terms of dropping out of the top four and no chance of winning the title. So it must be odd. But when you see, you know, Gundogan having a penalty saved when apparently he'd scored every penalty taken for City before then, and they'd scored in their previous 23 away Premier League games, part of you thinks, well, it was just, you know, one of those days where we could have played all day and all night and never scored. And another part of you thinks, well, Sterling's not in particularly good form. They're missing a lot of penalties. Aguero had that not easy chance, but chance where he could have squeezed the ball in at the near post, and that's not going in. So
big chance for Gundogan as well.
When he totally skied it. Yeah, so, I mean, something's not right, but it's a difficult thing to fix, I think. Actually, asked Frank Lampard about this last week, with Chelsea suffering from a similar thing, and saying, what do you do as a coach? How can you improve this in terms of your squad? And he said, well, it's just as boring as it sounds. You just have to do shooting practice all the time. But what you can never replicate is the in-game situation. So it's a difficult thing for a coach to get a handle on, I think.
As you mentioned penalties. One of the 14 shots I think that City had in this game was Gundogan's penalty, which Lloris saved. Should Man City actually have had another penalty straight afterwards, though.
It looked like the sort of challenge that is ordinarily given as a penalty. There was obvious contact between Lloris and Sterling, but I think what works against Sterling is the fact that he's going down before contact is made. I assume that's why the decision wasn't given. The best thing about that was Mourinho's reaction when he was reminded by one of his assistants that Sterling was on a yellow card for that pretty heinous challenge on Dele Alli from the first half, prompting Mourinho to race from his seat in the dugout and confront the fourth official, which was quite an amusing moment. But no, I think that was... I don't think it was a scandal that City didn't get a penalty for that.
It's fair to not... It sounds a bit mealy-mouthed, but the problem with that kind of penalty is I thought it was a foul and should have been a penalty, but Sterling was very clearly not going to keep the ball in play or get a shot away, so it wouldn't have been a sort of accurate punishment for the challenge to give such an easy chance to score a goal for what was not going to be a goal-scoring chance, essentially.
It's almost very satisfying to see common sense applied in this situation, whereas often it doesn't. But, I mean, talking about Sterling and the earlier challenge, which was to me was an ankle breaker, to be honest. It was, I immediately thought back to Aubameyang and Max Meyer the other week, except I thought this was more violent. And they reviewed that and didn't give it. I was very, very surprised because, again, people see the replay in the stands and in the media section, and it just goes, ugh, winces. So I'm surprised he actually was on the pitch in the first place that long.
Right.
Surprise, Graeme Souness defending Raheem Sterling's right to plant his studs in Dele Alli's ankle, pointing out that because they were England teammates, there obviously couldn't be any malice involved.
That might have helped Sterling's case in that Alli, unlike most other players on the pitch potentially, didn't react in a way that might have changed Mike Dean's mind. And maybe he should have done.
Sterling, who may potentially miss the next game or two anyway for City because he went off clutching his hamstrings, as far as we can tell. I mean, it all worked out according to Mourinho's wishes in a way that, say, the recent match at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium against Liverpool didn't. But to what extent was that red card for Zinchenko actually the difference in this game? It was goalless when he walked.
I think Spurs were about to start doing what they were doing against Liverpool, which is breaking quite well. I also thought, that situation, Zinchenko got booked in the arguments after the VAR incident. I mean, if you're going to do something as stupid as that afterwards, I think, you have to own it. But I thought there was 15 minutes of quite a bit of City pressure that I thought was about to wane. So I think Spurs were about to have the chance anyway. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I mean, there is a vulnerability to City this season that there hasn't been for the last two seasons. And it's odd that, you talk about them being profligate when they were the first team in, I think, Europe's top five leagues to hit 100 goals in all competitions. There aren't chronic goal-scoring problems there. But I think it's reminiscent for me of Guardiola's first season when they would have lots of possession but not always make the most of it. I think with City this season that every six or seven games they're going to have a game like this where they dominate possession, where they don't make it count, where they get caught out on the counter-attack, and then all the problems at the other end of the team where they're missing players, where Kompany hasn't been replaced, etc., 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 rear their head. And if City were taking those chances, then those issues wouldn't be as problematic as they are.
I'd say it's even worse. I think it's at most every four games, because City haven't won more than three games on the bounce at all this season. So every fourth game these problems came to haunt them.
As for Spurs, Matt, they were 11 points off the top four when Jose Mourinho took over, and the notion of them breaking into the Champions League positions at the time seemed fanciful. But yet here we sit now, they're only 4 points behind Chelsea, who they meet in a couple of weekends' time.
Yeah, 22nd of February at Stamford Bridge. Wow. And you remember the reverse fixture back in December. They had the chance to significantly cut the gap on Chelsea then and lost the game. So it's a huge one there. I mean, we've spoken a lot about Steven Bergwijn, and it seems sort of ironic that we're talking about a January transfer that Spurs have made, which is going to transform their season, which we all thought was going to be the first crack in the relationship between Mourinho and Daniel Levy. But they might have pulled off a masterstroke in getting him. But, it's one win for Spurs. It's not like they've been playing really well and been unlucky with their results. So I think we probably need to see them a couple more times before we'd say that, they're definitely going to crack the top four. And obviously they've got a game this week, which other teams don't, because they've got to play their FA Cup replay. So what impact is that going to have when other squads will either be, getting time off to go to the family or going away on training camps, etc.?
Tell you now, they've got to go to their FA Cup fourth round replay and get a result.
Unless you're Liverpool.
Yeah, a little bit of concern then at Stamford Bridge over the looming spectre of their former manager. Now, earlier on Sunday, Burnley, who never held the lead in a Premier League game against Arsenal, wasted the chance to change that in a goalless draw at Turf Moor. They had the chances, they didn't take them. It ended goalless. Here's a stat, this is pretty incredible, courtesy of Optus Tom Ead. Only runaway leaders Liverpool have lost fewer Premier League games than Arsenal this season.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? Of all the draws.
But
yeah.
You know what? Only Watford and Norwich, the bottom two sides, have won fewer Premier League games than Arsenal this season. Two sides of the Arsenal coin, Tom.
Indeed, yeah. It is the season of all the draws for Arsenal. They eclipsed their record for draws in a single Premier League campaign today, which was, of course, the Invincible season, 03-04, when they drew 12 games. That didn't prevent them from streaking to the title in record-breaking fashion. And I think, I mean, looking at Arsenal's more recent form, that's four successive league draws against Palace, Sheffield United, Chelsea and Burnley. They're now unbeaten in seven games, all competitions, but have only won three in nine since Mikel Arteta came in. And I think what that demonstrates is that he has done what you would hope a new manager does when they take over a struggling team, which is to make them hard to beat. Mm. The next challenge, the most difficult challenge, will be making them a team who actually beat teams.
Well, he was preparing them for what I think he expected to be a physical game against Burnley by making them train with tackling dummies. The banter being that, you know, they've been using those at centre-half for the last year. As for Burnley, though, who are level on points with Arsenal, let's not forget, behind on goal difference, but level on points. Extraordinary stuff. They're well clear once again of the nasty business down at the bottom.
Yeah, I mean, they looked like they were potentially sliding towards trouble. They had a run of four straight defeats, but then in the last three points against Leicester, 3 points at Man United, and then a draw against Arsenal, which they came away from feeling disappointed they hadn't won because they hit the bar and had all these chances. So you kind of feel like that, you know, that this has been a very fruitful period for Burnley, and they'll go into the break feeling a lot more optimistic about the rest of the season.
But it's a bit of a mad dynamic down there, though, because team slide and then two wins, Bournemouth, which we're going to get, and two wins, and suddenly the picture completely changes and someone else is struggling. So I think we've been on the show before trying to sort of, you know, look at who is likely to go down, but I don't think I'm bothering anymore because
really,
picture
Matt's
changes.
Matt's already booked Bournemouth for a trip down.
I said that Bournemouth might get relegated, yeah, but I mean, there's not that much difference, or there won't be in a couple of weeks, between sort of going for Europa League qualification and battling relegation. You know, you look at somebody like Newcastle.
Yeah. So what's the top points. Seven would it be for Europa?
12 points between 5th and 17th. And I think that is a reflection of the fact that this is, Liverpool aside, a pretty low-quality Premier League season.
Right.
You've got one historically exceptional team. You've got a Man City team who've obviously fallen back. You've got a few teams punching above their weight, Leicester, Wolves, Sheffield United. You've got a whole host of underperforming big clubs. And as Southampton have demonstrated recently, as Watford demonstrated before, they sort of slipped back more recently, as Bournemouth might be about to demonstrate, you go on a run of wins and you can go from the relegation scrap to a few points off Europe.
Right, I mean, that cluster of teams, Arsenal, Burnley, Newcastle and Southampton, all on 31 points, they are all pretty much as close to fifth as they are to the relegation position.
But you'd say Arsenal got no chance of getting relegated, but you'd think, well, Newcastle, you know, a couple more dodgy results and they'd be right back down there.
We'll touch on the battle at the bottom very shortly. Next up, though, Tom, you went to the King Power and are about to tell us all about what happened there.
Join Ruby Walsh, Paddy Power, Tom Nugent and a whole host of great guests each week on Paddy Power's new racing podcast, From the Horse's Mouth. Tune in for analysis, interviews and a bit of crack. Ruby is the expert, Tom holds it together and Paddy, well, Paddy's funding the whole thing so he insisted that he gets to be involved. The first episode is available to download now.
On Spotify, smart speaker and podcast platforms everywhere. This is the Totally Football Show from Muddy Knees Media.
Match week 25 of the season kicked off Saturday lunchtime at the King Power Stadium. Tom, you were there to witness a saucy 2-2 draw between third place and fourth place sides in the Premier League. At the Bridge Pod tweets us and says, did Chelsea find their backup striker in the form of Antonio Rudiger? Lols.
Yeah, Antonio Rudiger, who scored two fantastic headers, the second one in particular, was one of the best headers I've seen in a long time.
What was so good about it?
So it was a free kick out on the left that Mason Mount took, same formula that had led to the first goal, a set piece from Mount, header from Rudiger. And Rudiger is a good sort of 15, 16 yards from goal. There's not a huge amount of pace on the ball. Leaps like the proverbial salmon and a proper sort of like neck muscles being tensed. Are these really tensing muscles?
Yeah. Is it Andy Carroll-esque?
Andy Carroll-esque, and he puts it right in the top left corner, past the despairing dive of Kasper Schmeichel. But the fact that Chelsea had needed Antonio Rudiger to score two goals, his first goal since October 2018, was a sign that the players who Frank Lampard would have hoped would score those goals hadn't quite been up to it. Tammy Abraham, who we know was playing through the pain of an ankle injury, squandered a few first half chances. And as we've seen with Chelsea quite a lot this season, they started the game very well, very aggressive, got forward well. Leicester were quite sleepy, but then didn't make the most of it. And within, you know, less than a minute of the start of the second half, they're behind. Bit of a topsy-turvy second half. They come away with a point that's not a bad point, but yeah, not a formula that they're going to be able to use all that often, I wouldn't have thought.
Well, but they were playing Leicester, you know, who are above them in the table and are having, by anyone's standards, a pretty decent season. I think Chelsea actually played quite well in this game. There's a couple of big selection calls from Frank Lampard.
Right. One of them, and the bigger one we'll come on to in a second, but first of all, the fact that Tammy Abraham was playing through pain and Batshuayi didn't get on, Olivier Giroud wasn't even called up, that's slightly surprising or not?
Giroud hasn't been in the matchday squad for quite a long time. I wouldn't imagine that his fitness is particularly at a point where he'd be ready to take part in a Premier League game. I also think he's one of those players who's grown better in his absence.
Right. Okay.
He's made a lot of substitute appearances for Chelsea, but he's also scored 5 goals in 45 Premier League games.
It's not all about scoring goals.
No, he's not. But things that he is about are not things that are what Frank Lampard is looking for his Chelsea team to do. You need to be more mobile than Giroud is to actually effectively work in Chelsea's system, I think, which is probably why he doesn't.
You do, but like, you also need a plan B when plan A isn't working. And I think, and I've long thought this, I think as an alternative on the bench, I think Olivier Giroud is one of the best plan Bs out there. I mean, his goal scoring record is not great, and you know, he's obviously in a bit of a hump about not getting his transfer to Inter Milan. But I find the extent to which he's been frozen out at Chelsea really, really surprising. The fact that he's not getting any minutes, that he's not even getting called up into squads. And this is a fit World Cup winning centre forward who is very adept at bringing other players into the game, whose previous strike partners have all loved playing with him. And I just think that when there are issues about Chelsea's ability to take chances, I don't know why Lampard wouldn't have at least tried him a bit more.
Is it a purely technical question, Matt, do you think? Or might there be some issues?
No, I don't think so. I mean, not the way that Lampard has spoken about Giroud. I think he could have sugarcoated something more than he has if he actually had a problem with him. I think he was out the door. From what I understand, it was Inter who pulled out of the transfer, essentially. So they were planning for life without him and he was planning to leave. So he hasn't been in the thinking. So don't throw him straight in.
But do you think, as Alan Shearer said the Sunday Match of the Day yesterday, I mean, he obviously was slightly sugarcoating, but is Abraham actually a problem now? The fact that he is not getting in the right positions, not converting the chances that he should be perhaps making a bit more of. Because, I mean, for example, a couple of weeks ago, the Newcastle game, he had presentable half chances, which you feel maybe a striker should at least convert one of them into a proper chance, and Abraham wasn't doing that.
Yeah, I mean, potentially. I think the bigger problem is that he doesn't see Batshuayi as a reliable alternative either, and the evidence this season is that he's right to think that, because in terms of the Premier League, he's been almost completely ineffective. So I'm not sure if it's Abraham is the problem or the fact that there's not an alternative solution. We've got to remember this is Abraham's first season as Chelsea number nine, and there was always going to be this period with players like him and Mason Mount. I think he'll come back fine in a couple of weeks, but he, in an ideal world, wouldn't have played this game because he had a heavily bruised ankle.
Right, because Chelsea would have exploited the end of their transfer ban to go out and buy some of that killer instinct that Frank's been banging on about for weeks.
Yeah, I mean, it's not as if that there was a plethora of top-quality strikers who were moving between clubs in Europe in January, is it? I think probably the options were quite limited, but certainly Lampard was very cross that he didn't manage to get anybody in during the window.
OK, what about the really big decision? The most expensive goalkeeper in the history of football sat on the bench.
Yeah, and I don't think he can have any complaints because his form's not been anywhere near good enough this season. Caballero's not an outstanding goalkeeper, particularly at his age, the oldest player to play in the Premier League this season, but he's a capable deputy, and if this focuses Kepa's mind to try and get back to where, I mean, where he was at Athletic Bilbao, he's never been hugely convincing for Chelsea, but you've always kind of thought of him as early era David De Gea at Man United, and maybe once he gets used to the league a little bit, then things will turn for him. But it's a wake-up call for him, certainly, and it wasn't a surprise, which is the most surprising thing about it, I think.
Really? The timing of it felt quite deliberate in that there's now basically best part of 3 weeks until Chelsea play again, so it is something that Kepa is going to have to stew over for a bit, and I suspect that was probably done deliberately. And I think because there is that break coming up, it did feel like a one-off to me rather than the start of a new goalkeeping regime.
We saw Lampard after the Arsenal game, and as far as he was trying to control himself, I thought he was quite irritated with that second Bellerin goal. And he must think that he should have done much, much, much better there. Mm. And I think there's general weakness about, I think, how Kepa plays, which doesn't help the back line at all.
Leicester, still third, still, but have now dropped 8 points from winning positions in their past four Premier League games. That sounds like an awful lot to me. And they got knocked out of the cup in that time, the League Cup, by Aston Villa. What's up, Tom? Is anything up?
Jamie Vardy has stopped scoring, which
since
is one issue.
He had a kid.
Is it? Well, yeah.
It is.
Maybe it's those sleepless nights. Seven games in all competitions without a goal. He only really had one half chance against Chelsea, Willy Caballero said, although he did tee up fantastic late chance for Harvey Barnes. And Vardy himself actually had his arms aloft in celebration, in expectation,
as did
Brendan Rodgers on the touchline. Yeah, Leicester, I mean, they've obviously had a bit of a wobble. Back-to-back defeats against Southampton and Burnley, beat West Ham, but then, you know, it's West Ham. And then the draw against Chelsea. I think this break comes at a good time for them. I mean, their form in the run-up to the turn of the year was so good that they do have a little cushion there in third place. So I don't think there's any sort of great drama. But I mean, that defeat by Villa in the Carabao Cup semi-final, that will have pained them, because that would have been a great and a worthy reward, I think, for the football they played this season. But yes, I would have thought that after the break, they'll come back firing on all cylinders.
Still no Ndidi. So he tried to come back and he wasn't back for this.
The warm-up.
Exactly. So, I mean, is he being rushed back a little bit too quickly?
And look what's happened to Soyuncu. I thought it was terrible in the first half of this game.
He's been terrible ever since Ndidi isn't there. He's been
And Maddison kept quiet by Kante, who had his best game in a while. So, you know, we're talking Ndidi, Soyuncu, Maddison and Vardy, Leicester's best players this season, all off the ball at the same time.
I hadn't realised that Soyuncu's first name is pronounced Shaglar,
yes,
which sounds a bit like a bantery nickname from Gavin and Stacey. Leicester handed out a little pronunciation sheet with some pronunciation tips, and that was on there. I've been saying Shaglar, I think.
And it should be
Shaglar.
Shaglar.
Shaglar Soyuncu.
Sheffield United are in sixth place, just 1 point behind Spurs and a point ahead of the likes of Man United and Wolves. This after their 1-0 win at Crystal Palace, where the work was largely done for them, Sasha, by the unfortunate Palace keeper Vicente Guaita.
I would completely agree with Roy Hodgson.
Can we just celebrate the comedic quality of his own goal there?
It's, as a Russian, we have been scarred by a keeper dropping it in the playoff in 99 against Ukraine with 2 minutes to go. So this brought back many unhappy memories. But Guaita has been a huge part of the Crystal Palace, well, relative success this season, because he's the keeper who saves much more than he should. Most in the Premier League. If you look at the XGA, goals against, Palace should have conceded 10 more goals this season. And the reason they haven't is Guaita. And actually, similar thing for Sheffield United, because second best behind Guaita is Henderson, who of course made that horrible mistake against Liverpool earlier this season.
Right.
To which Roy Hodgson, backing Guaita, he can't possibly criticise him, he's been amazing. Chris Wilder, when Henderson did it, this kid thinks he's going to play for Man United one day. He can't do that.
But look at his form since then.
How quickly do you think he might be playing for Man United?
It's interesting. I mean, you know, I certainly think he'd be in the England squad this summer. But in terms of Man United, De Gea's got ages on his contract. He's on massive money, isn't he? So they'll probably want to get the maximum value out of him. Good thing, of course, for Henderson is that he's probably, what do you reckon, Sash, at least 5 years from his prime as a keeper? Into your mid-30s?
Well, I mean, look at his quality right now. And the thing is as well, I think he's actually got quite a sweet deal here, because he can wait for De Gea to go, because Sheffield United would definitely have him for as long as he stays, and Sheffield United are a top half Premier League team. So why would you even bother with anything else?
For Palace, meantime, fine though he has been between the posts, they are the lowest scorers in the division. This was the 20th time in the last 25 games that they've failed to score anything in the first half, for what that's worth. Ed Quoth the Raven, who I think you bumped into in a coffee shop recently.
Sure did.
Matt says, would anyone like to counter Matt's Bournemouth are in trouble sentiments with a word on Palace and the fact that they're in relegation form with a knackered old squad with absolutely zero morale? It's an interesting take on the Eagles.
Zero morale?
It is relegation form. Six league games without a win. Mm. Only one win in the last 10.
They're 6 points clear.
6 points clear. And I think the thing with Palace is there is a sort of fundamental hardiness to them that, yes, they don't score goals, and that has been a problem for, what, the last two, three seasons, if not more. But because, generally speaking, they let very few goals in, they still manage to grind out results. So, my expectation would be that they'll manage to keep the relegation zone at arm's length. But it can't be huge fun being a Palace fan. Great atmosphere, though, you often get at Selhurst Park. Going to the game knowing that the best you can hope for is like a scratchy 1-0 win because none of your strikers can be relied upon to score goals. Wilfried Zaha isn't quite as effective as he was last season in that respect. And it is just a succession of kind of like, you know, grinding performances. But that, I suppose, the other side of that coin is that will probably be enough to get them, you know, to get them away from trouble.
But this is the crazy thing, whereby it seems of course Palace's style is more it's more suited to being away from home, etc., etc., and so on. But when you go to Palace, it's genuinely great atmosphere when they equalise and they push forward. You know, you feel as though they should be scoring more goals here, but for whatever limitation, they just aren't.
Could have been massive for them if they got Jared Bowen instead of West Ham.
Jared Bowen, by the way,
goal scorer.
He's a good player.
Jared Bowen, you say, who was top scorer in the Championship since the start of last season, is that right?
Yeah, he got 22 goals last season alone. He got 14 or 16 this time around. They dried up a bit in the last month as he'd been touted for a move away, and Hull's form had gone south too. But yeah, really, really good get for West Ham, I think. And on the evidence of Saturday, certainly needed, although maybe there are other areas for improvement. That
right, Saturday, which saw them 3-1 up against Brighton, with 20 minutes to go, a cruising effectively, and ending up drawing 3-3.
Lots of exceptionally scrappy goals in this one.
Bonner scoring an own goal is probably my highlight.
But really, that's such a foul.
That
wasn't
enjoyable.
Even his fault, though.
Punching against his head. But yeah, both of Snodgrass's goals were deflected in by Brighton defenders.
But they were so well hit, though.
They were beautifully hit because Robert Snodgrass has got an absolute hammer of a left foot, but nonetheless needed deflections. And then what was the really bantery goal? I'm trying to think.
I liked the banter-wise. I liked the first goal, sorry, the Diop goal, where you hear Matt Ryan shout, "Keepers!" as Diop heads it into the net.
Oh, my word, yeah.
And then the second Brighton goal, which tees things up for Glenn Murray's late equaliser, where the ball is bouncing on the edge of the West Ham box and Ogbonna and Diop both sort of look at each other before Diop decides that he's going to attempt the gentlest back header you've ever seen. And Pascal Gross runs in and stabs it past the keeper. And then, you had that slightly confusing equaliser that was initially ruled out for handball, because when you saw it, the instinctive reaction was, oh, that looks like handball.
And I thought West Ham players stopped just for that split second. And I think Fabianski could have done a little bit better there as well.
Great entertainment.
Still, you're two goals up at home to Brighton, who've won one game in about the last year with especially 20 minutes to go. What does this say about West Ham under David Moyes? They've had six games without a win in all competitions. They've also lost more points from winning positions than any other Premier League side this season. That's not entirely his fault, of course, but for the supporters watching from the stands, there's little there to give them confidence.
Yeah, I mean, the new manager bounce lasted all of 90 minutes of that 4-0 win against Bournemouth, and since then it's been five league games without victory. And I think as this very knockabout game against Brighton demonstrated, that West Ham remain a very patchy team. And watching that, I don't think you would have any great confidence about their ability to go on a winning streak.
A winning streak. What are the chances of that, looking at their upcoming fixtures?
Very unlikely, I would suggest. Man City and Liverpool away, or the other way around. They've also still got to go to Arsenal, Spurs and United before the end of the season. And Suchek looked all right. That's a little positive for them from this game, but they are very much in a relegation scrap.
But also, I mean, when things aren't going right for you, I mean, that foul on Fabianski for the first goal, I mean, why wasn't that picked up by VAR? Murray's holding his arm. He can't move. That's why it looks so absolutely ridiculous, because he's being fouled.
There were, I mean, a few VAR shockers this weekend, sadly, once again.
But it's the West Ham, it's whatever this counts for, I do think it counts for something. It's the mood around the club compared to the other team. You know, you think even Norwich, that there's a mood of, well, we might go down, but, you know, it's nice being in the Premier League for a bit. Watford, all right, the results have tailed off a bit, but you can see what they're trying to do. Other teams around there, Brighton, okay, don't get great results, playing good football. Bournemouth have put together a couple of wins, seem to have a decent spirit. It doesn't seem to be any positivity around West Ham, any element of the football club at all at the moment.
Right.
That feels quite dangerous.
Or in the ground. I mean, it's just a terrible place to watch football, especially if your team isn't playing well.
Okay. We'll talk about some of those other teams. How about Watford and their remarkable game against Everton up next?
You're listening to The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Now Moyes Keane has got a touch into the path of Richarlison, and Everton are on the counter-attack here. Richarlison into the penalty, and Moyes Keane, he misses his kick. Can Walcott steer it home? He certainly can! And Everton have surely won it!
An arguably even more impressive comeback than Brighton's at the London Stadium came courtesy of Carlo Ancelotti's Everton at Vicarage Road. The shots of the Watford fans on the final whistle, just stunned, unable to process what had just taken place in front of their eyes. Not just because Theo Walcott scored a goal. It was the fact that they'd been, 2-0 up? And then Yerry Mina.
Yeah, so in a kind of inversion of what happened to Everton in that game against Newcastle when they let in 2 stoppage time goals to a centre-back, they scored 2 stoppage time goals in first half stoppage time. 2 from Yerry Mina in the space of 3 minutes. And then, as Carlo Ancelotti himself admitted in his post-match interview, at 2-2, and with Fabian Delph having been sent off after getting a completely needless second yellow card for a foul on Capu out on the touchline, Ancelotti quite content with the draw. And then they launched that late breakaway. Moyes Keane completely scuffs his attempted shot and Walcott finishes in to score. But interestingly, if you looked at the XG, it was 0.89 for Watford to 2.72 for Everton.
Really?
Which suggests that actually that was quite a fair result.
A fair result.
I suppose the physiognomy of the game meant that with Everton going a man down and having come back from 2-0 down, you thought, oh God, 2-2 will be a really good result here. But perhaps in actual fact, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't the daylight robbery that some of Watford's fans might have thought.
I also liked Pearson's choice of words to describe those 2 goals just before halftime and defending on them as regrettable. with a very stony face.
Right.
Because in fact, some defending on those corners was in fact regrettable. Messina blocks Foster for the first one and Cathcart just stumbles over when the second one is scored. And Messina as well, despite scoring, I think, the first goal, the third goal is also his fault because he loses the ball deep into Everton half and they get hit in the break.
Theo Walcott, I mean, lovely to see him scoring. Is he a player that makes you feel a little bit melancholy?
Yeah, because he hasn't achieved what he ought to have achieved.
I mean, he's had a great career by most mortal standards.
I mean, he's had a decent career, but, you know, when he was in the England World Cup squad in 06 at 17, you were thinking sort of Wayne Rooney levels. Well,
scoring hat-tricks away in Croatia.
Yeah, quite. Well, and there was a great, his interview post-match, he said that Carlo Ancelotti had relaxed him before the game by saying, you know, you are allowed to score goals.
Well, he'd also been taunted by the Athletic's Michael Cox, who included him in this feature about 25 players who haven't scored yet and what they need to do to sort that out. And actually, he revealed that he subscribes to The Athletic. So you imagine, read that. Maybe he got some tips from Michael and bingo.
Yeah, maybe. On the Ancelotti quote, I do feel like Ancelotti's a really good fit for Everton at the moment. In like the last few managers, there's been this kind of almost mania around them of, we've got to do this now and we've spent all this money, whereas Ancelotti seems to have breezed in and gone, yes, you know, another job, it's nice to be back in England, we'll try and win a few games and see where it takes us, and everything's just a bit more relaxed and seems to be going all right.
I think that's the thing. I think maybe it takes someone like Ancelotti to just get the whole place to chill out a bit about just everything, because I think Everton, by the time he arrived, were basically going off a cliff a bit psychologically.
And only 1 defeat in 8 in the league since he came in, which is what a new manager bounce should look like.
Yeah, we looked at that form table, didn't we, to check out if there was another good team right now in the Premier League, and they were about as close as it got.
8 points off the top 4.
Remarkable. What about Watford then? They are now 2 points from safety, while your old friends Bournemouth are the same margin outside of the bottom three now, Matt, after their very important win against Villa.
Is this my Jeff Shreves moment where I have to apologise to Bournemouth? Yeah, I mean, they picked up a couple of good wins. They played well in the game against Villa and deserved to win it. Obviously, they had an advantage in that Villa had had a really emotionally and physically energy-sapping game in midweek, and Bournemouth had had a free week to prepare for the game. But they played a lot of it with 10 men and still managed to win it. So, yeah, well done.
Well done. Villa finally got a headed goal, first one this season. They finally got a Tanzanian player as well. But they remain the only Premier League side yet to keep a clean sheet away from home. Oh, Bournemouth owners were wearing face masks to guard against the coronavirus. That, and I don't want to under... That seems a little bit early scenes of an apocalyptic film, you know. There's a football game and in the background people are already wearing masks.
It's quite exciting. There is like an element of like Hollywood about it, but it feels slightly unnecessary.
I used to sell those type of masks to the building services industry before my time in football, and the ones they were wearing did not have adequate filtration on them to keep out viruses, so they would have been basically
skipping out dust rather than viruses.
Okay. What was your job, Matt?
So selling personal protection equipment to the building services industry. So masks and defenders and hard hats and things like that.
Okay, yeah, yeah. And the masks for, building dust, asbestos.
Yes, exactly. So you have different levels of filters on the front of the mask depending on what nasties you're trying to keep out. But just from looking at those Bournemouth ones, coronavirus would eat through that.
You're saying you were rubbish at it? It was like a downturn in the building industry? Or
Yeah. I was a rubbish at it.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, what was that the strangest thing you did before finding your calling as a football commentator?
I used to take sort of plastic film off warehouse doors as well. I was quite good at that. But yeah, I worked in the call centre for
that
credit card.
A vocation,
company.
Actually. But
it wasn't for very long for me. But anyway, that vocation's loss is very much the football industry's loss as well.
Right. I imagine we've all done weird things. Have you got a quickie one you want to throw in, or shall I move on?
I used to work at a place called Dinosaur World in Colwyn Bay. I used to go there when I was a kid. I was a big dinosaur enthusiast as a kid, and it was full of big, roughly life-size but anatomically quite inaccurate models of dinosaurs.
Wow, when you say that, Tom, I can't help but form pictures.
And a soundtrack that sounded like a man growling into a tape recorder in his own bedroom. And then when I was a teenager, I found out one of my mates was working there. It was like a summer job, so I worked there, looking after dinosaurs. And you had to dress up as a dinosaur as well a couple of times a day.
Okay.
Which dinosaur?
Controversially, it was actually a dragon.
Not Gunnosaurus.
Yeah. And then they got a new dinosaur costume, but the neck on it was so long that it would get caught in low-lying tree branches.
Right.
So people just refused to wear it.
Right. You're quite a dinosaur, you know, you take them quite seriously.
I dabble.
Oh, unexpected treat time as we're joined by Nick Miller. Nick, why have you got ink all over your fingers?
Well, James, exciting news. We're doing a book. It's the Totally Football Yearbook.
Woo.
I know. It's out on August the 6th, but crucially, it's available to pre-order today.
That's a relief. So this is a yearbook, basically like, you know, the kind of famous football yearbooks, rounding up everything that's happened in this most story-packed campaign.
Yes, but with the classic Totally Football Show spin on it. There'll be accounts of every Premier League team's seasons. There'll be also accounts of every Championship team's seasons.
Wow.
All the Euroleagues from our friends on the European edition of the Totally Football Show. We'll also have stuff on the Women's Super League from our friends at the Offside Rule. There'll be a Scottish football section from JJ Bull from this Totally Scottish Football Show.
Makes sense.
And some in-depth coverage of the Football League from Caroline Barker and Adrian Clark.
Outstanding. Will there be quizzes as well?
There'll be quizzes.
Fun stuff.
There will be pictures all over the place.
Yeah.
All your favourite features from the Totally Football Show podcasts. And plenty more besides.
Right. Sounds like it's going to be a mighty tome indeed, Nick.
It will be. It'll be your go-to reference for the season just gone and looking ahead to the season after that as well.
Invaluable. Thanks so much for stopping by, Nick Miller.
No problem. Thank you very much, James.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
There were other games taking place this weekend. They didn't necessarily involve goals. Newcastle Norwich certainly had none. Neither did the clash at Old Trafford between Man United and Wolves. In fact, this is now three goalless games in a row for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's side. He said afterwards, "How many teams break Wolves down? Not many. But I think, as people have pointed out, lots of teams actually do.
You accuse the groundsman of moving the goalposts as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
With a chuckle.
Yeah, but feels like he's reaching a little bit at the moment.
Mm. I mean, we did wonder who was going to score the goals for Manchester United in the absence of Marcus Rashford, and we now have the answer, and that answer is nobody.
Right, although new signing Bruno Fernandes did have a pop, or three pops actually, three of United's five shots on target were his.
Mm, and he's what United need, particularly in the absence of Pogba. There is very little forward thrust in that midfield. They're very dangerously dependent on Rashford and Anthony Martial, and when Martial's having an off day, there's no one else in that team who you can rely on for a goal. So to have a proper goal-scoring attacking midfielder, I think it's a sign that makes a lot of sense. And you know, from what I gather, he did have, you know, a big influence on their play in that respect, Fernandes.
And also, I think it shows, the stats show that the game's completely upside down, because they had 15 shots, but 10 of them were from outside the box.
Right.
It should really be the other way around.
Right. Someone like him, though, whilst bringing a lot of positive qualities, are they not the kind of qualities that require a different kind of mindset from his teammates?
Is
United a team that he can work in?
I mean, I don't know. I guess we'll soon find out. I think that, you know, I think that he brings United something that they have not had in Pogba's absence. And yeah, I think it, you know, you look at what Solskjaer is trying to do to United, basically just turn them into a quite one-dimensional counter-attacking team.
Right.
And having a guy like Fernandes, who takes a lot of shots and who is a threat, similar to someone like Ruben Neves, you think, who was on the other, you know, the other side of the pitch,
right,
on Saturday, that presents a new problem for teams. If you know that it's not just the threat of Rashford and Martial,
right,
and James running in behind, but there's also a guy who you can't allow to take aim at goal within 25 yards.
So Paul Scholes is the analogy that Solskjaer himself made. Do you see that?
I think isn't Bruno Fernandes a bit higher up than that? And also, I think Neves is a bit deeper. But watching that game, I thought, this is the guy who's being brought in to transform United, which I think is a lot of pressure on this one guy.
Yeah, it's not a helpful comparison to compare a Manchester United midfielder to Paul Scholes either, is it?
Mm.
After his debut, it's quite a lot of pressure.
Well, he's not having to turn things around on his own, because there's also Odion Ighalo.
Yeah, of the famed partnership at Watford with Deeney. Which, again, you look at that signing, you think, yo, United, is this what it is now? I mean, I know it's a temporary signing, but United signing Ighalo feels like this would have been unthinkable 3-4 seasons ago. This is a Watford-level striker they're trying to
bring. It was kind of unthinkable about a week ago when Solskjaer said, we're not going to look for a short-term solution in the transfer window. Possibly that was just a little bit of depistaggio, as the Italians say, like just a kind of little dummy there. But, is it actually a decent move? Because he scored some Premier League goals before. And
I mean, it will depend on how well he does. If he scores 8, 9, 10 goals between now and the end of the season, we'll think it was a great bit of business. And it's actually quite risk-free, because there's no commitment beyond the end of the season. If it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. They got an extra body in, you know, because of his profile, because we last saw him playing for Watford and he's come from China, and because it's the great Manchester United, the tendency is to, you know, be a bit snide about it. But it's the sort of move that the big clubs have kind of stopped making in recent years, because they've got so much money they don't need to take weird punts like this. They can just go and spend 30 million on whoever. And I think one of the successful things that Liverpool have done is that they have bought in players for not huge money. You think about, you know, Andy Robertson being a prime example. There was mockery of Liverpool for signing the left back from relegated Hull when they did. He's now the best left back in Europe. And that's been part of the art of crafting title winning teams since the start of top-level football in this country. And okay, I'm not comparing Ighalo's signing to Andy Robertson's in that way.
Kind of are, though.
But it's, I think that I think one of the problems with the level of wealth that the big clubs have now is that old-fashioned team building has gone out the window. You can just go out and get, like, you know, the best guy in whichever league you want, because you've got the money to do it. And so these sort of slightly quirky left-field things don't happen so much. I mean, it's a bit of a gamble, but I think the risks are pretty low. If it works out, it works out. And if it doesn't, then he goes back to Shanghai at the end of the season. And, you know.
But Tom, with Robertson, you're talking about this crazy thing as long-term thinking, which is exactly what...
Yeah, well, exactly, yeah, that's it.
Which is not the situation United find themselves.
Yeah, I mean, not an exact comparison, but that sort of thinking of sort of like identifying gaps in the squad and you know, not just going and spunking 40 million on someone.
My other worry with Ighalo as well is he was very good for a season and a half, especially when he was up front with Deeney. But then as Kiko Sanchez-Flores lost sort of confidence in his system and tried to leave Ighalo up front on his own, or Deeney up front on his own, then Ighalo only scored three goals in a year before he actually was shipped off to China.
Right.
So I don't know if he's the type of guy who's just going to hit the ground running here for United, yeah, and whether he's a guy who needs a partner up top.
Worth pointing out as well, the Chinese Super League season finished on the 1st of December, so he's not coming in fit, fresh and raring to go. You know, it'll probably take him a month to get up to speed, and it's not like this Chinese Super League is the same pace or intensity as the Premier League.
A little bit of midweek action for you. We've got fourth-round replays, as was touched on previously. Tuesday sees Newcastle travel to Oxford. Also doing the replay thing are Birmingham Coventry. The winner gets to go to Leicester. Cardiff taking on Reading again. The winner hosts Sheffield United. Derby are up against Northampton Town. Oh, sorry, Wayne Rooney's Derby up against Northampton Town, which could be very interesting because the winner gets to host Man United. And Liverpool, Sasha, or kind of like shop brand Liverpool, will take on Shrewsbury, with the winner taking on going to Stamford Bridge. Mm-hmm. Oh, and then there's also Spurs-Saints. God, there's a lot of them, aren't there?
Spurs-Saints,
that's on Wednesday.
Wednesday, isn't it? Yeah,
yeah, they'll be at home to Norwich, whoever gets through that. Liverpool taking on Shrewsbury. Sasha, where do you stand on Jurgen Klopp's surprising decision not to turn up for this one?
I think it could have been phrased a bit better. I also think it is intentional to bring, I think, certain discussions to a head.
Right.
And as you saw, other managers have sort of been speaking out in support of Klopp. I think one of the reasons this is done like this is Liverpool's extreme frustration with how the Carabao Cup was handled.
In what way?
Well, generally, sort of EFL handled. And, you know, remember when they went to play in Qatar? They had to play the day before. So I think that sort of domestic scheduling certainly would not have helped Klopp's patience. And I think also generally, the league is the complete priority for Liverpool.
Of course, but you're 22 points clear.
The league is complete priority for Liverpool over everything else, I think. Also, I think you have to bear in mind that Liverpool also have another 3 months of the season to play afterwards. And I think the way that the modern football clubs are run, everything is mapped out a long time in advance.
Okay.
Squad cohesion, suddenly you have three or four guys maybe staying behind helping the kids when they thought they were going on holiday.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of things to come into it. Of course, it's unfortunate for Shrewsbury. But I also think that if you look at how the under-23s played at Villa, yes, they lost 5-0 in the Carabao Cup, but it wasn't a bad performance. So I actually think Liverpool have a pretty good chance of winning this game, even with the under-23s.
Well, Shrewsbury probably have quite a good chance of winning it, given that they didn't do too badly against the kind of half a first-team Liverpool. Basically, to sum up, while some of the rest of us might go, crikey, you're 22 points clear, you can afford to at least turn up as manager, but maybe even use one or two players. For Liverpool fans, this is the only thing that counts, the league, and it doesn't matter what happens as long as the league title is sorted.
Yeah. I mean, other things, I think it was a similar attitude last season as well until Champions League came sort of to the rescue. But even last season, I don't think Liverpool fans were particularly excited about the Champions League until the 3-1 win in Munich. And then everyone went, whoa, we're very close to the Champions League here as well. And then it helped make that season a success. So if you look at in this situation here, I think Liverpool, of course, will go for the Champions League again. But the league has been an obsession for 30 years. No Liverpool fan, I think, would come out and go, oh, yes, we'll have to respect the FA Cup. Because the only thing everyone thinks about is the league.
Fair play to Liverpool for at least pricing the game sensibly. £15 for adults, £11.50 over 65, £5 for young adults, £1 for juniors. So at least they're not trying to gouge the supporters.
Although, as you say, what had seemed like a money-spinning replay for Shrewsbury is fast looking like something quite different.
Yeah, well, they claim that they're going to get enough money to buy proper video analysis equipment and improve their training ground exponentially, so it works for them too.
I still think for Shrewsbury it's quite a big windfall. And I think even sensibly, I mean, how much more Liverpool could have charged for the game? I mean, looking at Liverpool ticket pricing history, you know, I think even if they charged 25, for example, for the game against Shrewsbury, I don't think the fans would have been very happy, to be honest.
Newcastle, as we mentioned, going to Oxford. Sean Saunders says, can you explain how Newcastle are so awful and yet sit comfortably mid-table with only 4 goals all season from attackers?
Part one
is everybody else, I think. You know, the fact that there are other teams that, well, there aren't other teams who have been putting together consistent runs. But
it's quite a good season to be a mediocre Premier League team, because you can get away with it to an extent that you might not have been able to do in previous seasons.
They have goal-scoring defenders, which helps as well. They've scored half the goals, haven't they? I wonder if Danny Rose might chip in with a few if he can find a decent chippy.
Do you think? Yeah, nice. Do you think he will? He'll be featuring in this game. And what of the Oxford side? Given that they've just lost two of their best players now on transfer deadline day.
Yeah, they have. Yeah, friend of the Totally Football League Show and Oxford supporter Simon Watts has clued me up on this. Shandon Baptiste and Tarek Fosu both going to Brentford late in the transfer window. Both key players, but Oxford don't own their ground, and you might remember the Kassam Stadium. It's this weird three-sided stadium.
The car park.
Yeah, they don't have a great amount of revenue coming in. They have to sell players. They've done it successfully in recent years. Think of likes of Kemar Roof and Fantasy Premier League's John Lundstrom was playing for Oxford. So this is just a necessary part of their business model, unfortunately, but it's not great for Carl Robinson, who's already complained about having to play 9 games in February. He's trying to engineer promotion from League One and has this another opportunity to face a Premier League side against whom they've impressed already this season. And yeah, he loses two of his key players, but this is what happens when you're a smallish size club for League One. You know, it's just the business of football, unfortunately.
90 minutes, possibly longer then, on Tuesday. Who knows what might happen for Carl Robinson and the Ewes. That's on Tuesday. Very shortly, we'll be looking at some of the big headlines from around the European football weekend. Why Neymar got booked for being flash and that kind of thing. Right now, though, let's hear from producer Ben and Paddy Power.
Good morning, everybody. Producer Ben here on the line with Lee Price from Paddy Power. Lee, let's look ahead to the FA Cup fourth round replays this week. Oxford, they're taking on Newcastle. Can they knock out the Magpies?
Oxford hadn't been on a great run prior to visiting St James's Park, but they followed that draw of a league win, which keeps them in the playoff hunt. So they're 5-2 to win this one, although they have gone out of two other cup competitions, the League Cup and the Football League Trophy, at the Kassam. As for Newcastle, they followed that first match of another goalless draw, their lucky home fans, and the Magpies are evens to win this one. A draw, and the lottery that follows, is 12-5.
All right then, moving on. Jose Mourinho loves winning silverware, but if he's going to do it at Spurs, they've got to find a way past Southampton. Is that going to happen?
Far from it for me to upset advert royalty such as Jose Mourinho, but we only make Tottenham fifth favourites to win the FA Cup at 17-2. That's behind City, Chelsea, United and Leicester, and ahead of Liverpool, with their commitment to the competition somewhat in question. Not by me, I hasten to add. As for this game, though, we think the Spurs will progress. It's 4-6, odds on they go through. Southampton 7-2 to win this match. The draw is 11-4.
And finally, Shrewsbury have got themselves a replay at Anfield. Jurgen Klopp won't be there. None of the first team will be there. What's that done to the odds?
We actually make it odds on that Jurgen Klopp visibly attends this match. Perhaps a well-advised PR exercise. We do make his Liverpool reserves favourite to win the game, of course, but they're not odds on to do so for the first time in what feels like forever, although it was actually just December in the League Cup game against Villa. The champions-elect are even to win this game. Shrewsbury are just 2-1 to win at Anfield. A draw is 11-4.
You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time. Recording is over 18s only. Terms and conditions apply. And when the fun stops, stop. Tuesday, we'll be bringing you the European edition of the Totally Football Show. That's up pretty much from dawn on Tuesday. Among the many exciting things we can be discussing in that one, a Maldini on the pitch for Milan. Daniel Maldini. The legacy continues. Also, Erling Haaland continuing his way. He got another brace this weekend. Insane. Dortmund with another 5-goal haul.
I also was quite impressed with his builder play as well. He looks like he's taking the duck to water. I mean, they battered a very poor Union team, and it was 5-0. But his whole builder play, the way he's linking up with the likes of Royce and Sancho, it's very, very impressive for a guy who just landed there, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. So 7 goals so far in less than 2 whole games. Of playing time.
Well, yeah, it's off playing time, yeah.
Yeah, insane. 5 goals for PSG as well. Plucky PSG getting the 5-0 win against Montpellier. But angry scenes, Tom Williams.
Yes, angry scenes involving both of PSG's superstars, Neymar and Kylian Mbappe. Neymar, who has been absolutely flying the last few weeks, he's been in the best form I think I've ever seen him, took an absolute kicking from what is quite a rugged Montpellier team. And there was a curious incident, I think it was in the first half, where he tried to pull off like a rainbow flick over a couple of defenders, which didn't come off. The ball went out for a throw-in. And then he had a conversation with the referee.
The referee appears to call him over and say, hey, stop that.
Yeah,
stop provoking them.
Cool it. And Neymar reacts angrily,
but
as I think he's
saying,
perfectly entitled
to. Don't do that flamboyant
stuff. It seemed to be that he was saying, stop winding up the opposition.
Right.
Neymar responds by saying, well, hang on, this is how I play. Like, you know, I'm just trying to play my football. And gets a booking for dissent. After the game, Presnel Kimpembe, who spoke in the Mix Zone, said that the referee had explained that he'd actually booked Neymar for trying to wind up Montpellier's players, which is absolutely ludicrous.
Yeah.
I feel there's probably going to be more to
come
from
this. How much of this was his pink haircut?
What, you think it's made him even more of a target, or made him even more...
I'm not sure. Provocative.
It is provocative.
But that's insane, Tom. So has there been an outcry against this referee, this puritanical killjoy official?
Yeah, there has. I mean, on sort of French football Twitter, for once, sort of almost unanimous backing for Neymar, because while he might be a slightly annoying guy to be playing against, you can't be telling a player like that not to express himself in the way that he was. Neymar furiously storms off the pitch at half time and starts having a pop at the fourth official in Portuguese. The fourth official replies, "Speak French," rather snootily, and Neymar responds in French, "Parle français, mon cul." Speak
right.
French, my ass,
yeah.
Which I thought was a very elegant way of dealing with it. Worth noting also, Kylian Mbappe, withdrawn with about 20 minutes to play, and had the latest in what has become a bit of mini succession of confrontations with Thomas Tuchel. I mean, Mbappe wants to be treated like Messi and Ronaldo. He wants to be left on the pitch until the last minute of every single game. At this point in the game, PSG, home and hose, Montpellier have given up the ghost. There is space, there are goals to be had, and Mbappe know that there is some stat padding to be done, and has this quite prolonged and quite heated conversation with Thomas Tuchel. I mean, Thomas Tuchel is trying to keep happy a dressing room that is full of big egos. He's bringing on Icardi for Mbappe at that time. And I think he's also trying to show that he is boss. But it's not the first time it's happened, and it's not a great look.
No. And indeed, the way it looks is kind of worrying for a club with the history of the power plays between players and a manager, because Tuchel's there almost imploring Mbappe not to cause a scene and for some time, and Mbappe just kind of storms off after a bit.
Yeah, and it's a proper power play, because, I mean, Mbappe's obviously annoyed. Every striker who gets taken off before the end of a game when he thinks there are more goals to be had is going to be annoyed. Tuchel could just let him walk past him and go and take his seat on the bench, but he decides to go and confront him, put his hands, like, you know, on either side of his face and sort of try and talk to him and calm him down, unsuccessfully. So, yeah, an interesting one. I mean, I don't think there's anything really profound beyond it, but odd, and this is perhaps also a reflection of the fact that the league untitled is once again an absolute cakewalk for PSG. But here we are after a very breezy 5-0 win, and we're talking about Neymar kicking off on with the officials and Mbappe kicking off on his own manager.
What some people do see behind it is perhaps the kind of first steps towards the summer transfer that Mbappe or his people might wish to see towards certain pastures, Iberian.
Iberian, so all the Liverpool fans are trying to start this, I think, flash mob of Mbappe to Liverpool, but I don't think that's going to happen.
Speaking of officials involved in foreign scenes of footballing madness, how about that second division clash between Girona and, help me out here, Matt Davis-Adams?
Girona and Fuenlabrada.
Okay, that'll do.
Yeah.
So, you may have seen this, listener. If you haven't, you need to seek it out, because it's extraordinary. Player is sent off and heads down the tunnel. VAR is then used
in the second division
and rescinds the red card. So there's a kind of an awkward pause while somebody runs down the tunnel, finds the player who was sent off.
Cristobal Marquez.
It was. Who then comes back on. And then what happens, Matt?
And he goes and finds the person with whom he's been agitating. Hey, it's me again. I'm back. And gets straight back into it and gets sent off again immediately.
And this time for good.
I mean, it's a glorious act of idiocy, isn't it? It's kind of what we're all here for in football, just that kind of boneheadedness. Delightful. Love to see it.
Sasha.
Angry Frenchman in Germany.
Oh.
RB Leipzig against Gladbach. Obviously, top of the table clash. Gladbach basically pressed the hell out of Leipzig in the first half, 2-0 up. And in the second half, Jan Sommer drops the ball. literally, and it's 2-1. And then Alassane Player, who scored the opener.
Player.
Starts screaming about some decision in the middle of the park. A ref comes over, books him. He says something else to the referee. Ref books him again. He's off. And eventually Leipzig equalised, I think, in the penultimate minute of the game. And while they're all fighting it out, Bayern go back top. So potential crucial game in the German title race gets decided by a French bloke screaming in the middle of the pitch.
That's magnificent. We'll hear more about that in Tuesday's Totally Football Show, courtesy of Raphael Honigstein. Tuesday also, we'll see a new episode of the Totally Scottish Football Show, in which they'll be discussing how Celtic are now 7 points clear in Scotland. Rangers drawing at home to Aberdeen. Totally Football League Show is out on Wednesday. Matt, you in charge again this time?
Certainly am, yeah. Basically, we'll be undoing everything that we said last week when we said, oh, Leeds are over their blip now because they beat Millwall, and Forest have got a chance of crashing the top two because they beat Brentford. Fast forward a couple of days, Leeds lose at home to Wigan, and Forest lose at Birmingham, and Brentford win 5-1 away because the Championship. We might also make reference, and you might do this on Tuesday too, to Anthony Robinson of Wigan's failed move to AC Milan. The poor lad was taken on a private jet to Milan, only to get off said jet and be told that the transfer had been cancelled. He was amongst the Wigan supporters at Elland Road on Saturday, watching his team, and his boss Paul Cook said, look, he's going to get a move to a big club. Paul Cook also said, I was absolutely devastated because I was hoping that Paolo Maldini was going to phone me, but he didn't. The club's officials did it between themselves, so he missed out on a call from Maldini.
This time, anyway. All right. Matt, just to finish off, your busy Sunday also involved another absolutely huge game, this one in the WSL, as first came up against second, Man City, taking on Arsenal.
Yeah, almost too much narrative in this game. So they'd met in the League Cup semi-final on Wednesday night at Arsenal. Arsenal won that game 2-1. Uh-huh. Manchester City were really disappointing. So it's Arsenal-Chelsea in the League Cup final at the end of this month. But yeah, going into the game, they were level on points, Arsenal and City. There was one goal separating them in terms of goal difference. And this is the last game that City coach Nick Cushing was in charge of before he goes off to be assistant to Ronnie Dyler at New York FC. I mean,
right.
Is that an upgrade? I'm not sure. But they won the game anyway, City. 2-1 thanks to goals from Pauline Bremer and Lauren Hemp. It was a really high quality second half. Arsenal pulled one back through Danny van der Donk. Always nice to say her name. But the real winners probably were Chelsea. I mean, they walloped West Ham 8-0, and it means that the situation at the top of the WSL table, City leading the way, they're a point clear of Chelsea, but Chelsea have got a game in hand on them, and now a far superior goal difference, and Arsenal have slipped back to third. And because it's so tight between these three, Arsenal have lost both games against Chelsea, and they've lost this one against Manchester City. We could look back at the end of the season and say that's where they lost the title, that's how significant this game was.
That 8-0 4 Chelsea against West Ham came without Sam Kerr as well.
Yeah, she's on international duty, but Beth England, who's having an absolutely monumental season, amongst the goals again, as was 16-year-old Emily Murphy, which if that doesn't make you feel bad about your life, I don't know what will, because I'm 37 and I've never scored a goal in a professional football game, and it's looking unlikely that I will at this point.
Anything else we should know about this week, Sasha?
I'd just like to mention Danny Ings.
Okay.
And Liverpool, because after the game at Anfield, in which there were some, you know, moments surrounding Ings. He was on the pitch, and a lot of Liverpool players, and Jurgen Klopp came up to him, gave him a hug, had a proper chat with the guy, and you know, Van Dijk came over, and then Trent Alexander-Arnold. And it's just nice to see, because I think Ings was very unlucky at Liverpool, two really terrible injuries, just didn't quite work out for him. I love the fact that he's doing so well at Southampton this season, and it's good to see that sort of affection between former colleagues.
That's nice, isn't it?
Nice wholesome note to end the show.
Yeah, good for you.
Thanks, Sasha.
Brilliant. Alrighty, that's where we wrap this Totally Football Show. Many thanks to Matt, Tom and Sasha for being with us. And you, listener, we will return as previously mentioned. Do hope you have a super time and join us again then. For now, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, please email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. Keep up to date with everything across our Totally Football network at The Totally Show on Twitter, and make sure you check out our brand new website too, thetotallyfootballshow.com.
Hello, I'm Andrew. Andrew Slaven, host of the Totally Scottish Football Show. And if you like football, you're going to love Scottish football. It's not all just Stevie G and Scott Brown up here. No, because we talk about all of the Scottish football. And geez, oh, it's great. There's actually a title race this year in the Premiership. Stevie G will be hoping not to slip up again. Hearts are tearing each other a new one. Motherwell are doing... Well, they're doing well. So, if you like your football to be competitive, have a title race and a ton of drama off and on the pitch, the Totally Scottish Football Show is most definitely for you. Grab Scottish football by the balls, just like Ryan Christie did, and listen to the Totally Scottish Football Show, available everywhere, even in England.
Marini's Media.